This is The Politics Lab, a podcast that puts politics under a microscope. On this week's episode, Bill and Phil reflect on the 30th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, ponder the complicated relationship between corporate America and Donald Trump, and close with a look at developments in the world of international law, including Ecuador storming the Mexican embassy, Nicaragua accusing Germany of genocide in Gaza, and Switzerland being found guilty of violating its citizens' right to a healthy climate. Now, let's go to the lab.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Politics Lab. My name is Bill Muck, and I'm a professor of political science at North Central College. And I'm joined by my colleague and best friend, Dr. Phil Barker, who's a professor of political science at Keene State College. Hey, Phil.
Hey, Bill. How are you?
I am so good after the eclipse. You know, it was a transformative thing. You know, it really sort of changed my outlook.
You say that in a way that is, like the words you're saying are very meaningful, but the tone with which you say it, I'm skeptical. So you weren't like in the path of totality or any of that, right? How much of an eclipse did you get?
I heard the number 94%, okay. Which was a lot, right? And so we were actually, campus was, it was amazing how many people were out on campus watching it. But the light got a little weird, but it didn't get dark the way that, like, I guess Indiana and other parts where it got dark. Now you were the same, right? You didn't have the totality.
We were a little bit more than you. We were like 97% or whatever, but I think I wasn't. So it was really cool to see. And campus had, telescopes set up and all sorts of other stuff. And so it was really neat to get to see it and look at, sunspots and all sorts of other stuff. But I was, talking to people and seeing pictures of places where it was total. I would have thought that 97% versus total would have been pretty similar. But it seems like it went, dark in places where it was total. And I was sort of expecting something like that. And it got a little sort of greenish and a little dim and it cooled some, but that was kind of it. But it was still really neat.
It is great to look at. I decided not to use the glasses because I think it's sort of the same effect, but no, just kidding. It was like a real deal. People, everybody was sort of policing this. Make sure you have your glasses on. And maybe it was just me. Maybe they think I'm the idiot that isn't going to wear the glasses because I had so many people tell me to wear glasses.
I did see afterwards that there was a couple of things online that were showing that like Google searches for my eyes hurt, like skyrocketed in the moments after the eclipse. So.
I wonder, I'm sure there are idiots who weren't wearing glasses, but I also, there's probably like a psychological dynamic. Like I was sure I always had my glasses on, but I also still like, I felt like, do my eyes hurt now? Did something happen? Did I accidentally look at the, But I do think, because people, I thought it was a neat event, but I wasn't transformed the way some were. But I think you're right. If you were in one of those places where there was a complete blackout, that would be a pretty astonishing thing to experience where it suddenly, so that would have been something to see. And some of the videos of that were remarkable.
So were y'all pretty close? Like around here, like the interstates were like totally jammed and backed up everybody was trying to get, because we were close enough that, we're like a 2 hour drive. So everybody was trying to get within the path of totality, which seems I understand now why that would be really cool, but it is still probably outweighed by my dislike of traffic and crowds, which would have still kept me at home.
Which is grown. Like when we've traveled now, if there's a little slowdown at an intersection, Phil Barker is frustrated.
I'm an old man.
In Chicago, I'm just used to traffic, and it's always fun to see you like, what's going on here? Why are we stopping?
Well, it's amazing how quickly you adapt, because I used to live in big cities and was used to that. But a decade in Keene where, you have to sit through a traffic light more than once and you're like, this is some serious traffic. you adapt pretty quick.
I could see that. So before we dive into our real topics, the other thing that there was some news out of Arizona. You were telling me about abortion laws that were going back in time. Give me up to speed.
Yeah. So speaking of things that happen every couple hundred years.
Yes.
No. Yeah. I haven't had a chance to read all the details, but apparently Arizona's Supreme Court upheld a law from the 19th century, the 1860s, something like that. That is basically a total ban on abortion, except in the case of threat to the mother's life. So even like incest and rape and all of that stuff is no, you're that's illegal. Yeah. Abortion in those cases is illegal. So Yeah, I mean, I guess the court has said, you know, it could be that legislation can be changed or whatever. But yeah, it's yeah. Is it a good idea to be falling back on 150-year-old laws to govern like things that are, you know, science and medicine haven't advanced much since the 1860s, right? No. So we're okay.
It really is revealing of those who want to go back in time, right? Who thought like things were better a couple hundred years ago versus those who are saying like, we still have some work to do. It is surprising. And along with that, there was Donald Trump came out this week and announced his position on abortion, which is the states should choose, right? Which is the biggest cop out in the world, right? Because he knows this is a political liability. Yep. Like Arizona, like having that is, you know, is better for Joe Biden, right? Because it reminds people of the overturning of Roe v. Wade and the conservative Supreme Court. Now there's Florida's having a referendum on abortion as well and is likely to help the Democratic cause. And so I think Trump thinks I can just navigate this middle by saying the real, just let the states choose.
Is that going to be effective at all? I mean, so he's just trying to distance himself from a unpopular policy, but it feels like that's like, you know, when you've put the, I don't know, I sort of think it's not a personal thing in that, meaning it's a party thing at this point. The Republican Party is going to be held responsible, but he is also the one who put the justices on the Supreme Court and has bragged about it for all this time. It's hard to imagine that that's going to work, but I don't know. Voters aren't always the savviest, so.
No, that's right. Now, I still think that Democrats on this particular issue have a real advantage. I think they're being smart in terms of these referendums and raising this. And I'm guessing this is going to be highlighted dramatically across the country as time moves on. I think people will see Trump for what he is, right? He is somebody who's always calculating about where, you know, I don't think he has real positions on a lot of issues. So we'll, yeah, but it feels almost worse, right? I think he would have been better off taking a stand that was consistent with his policy than sort of this, I think he thinks he found this brilliant solution. Right. I'm going to let the states, everybody's going to see it. God, it's just.
If there are voters who are looking for some sort of thing to grab onto that allows them to vote for him, this, you know, maybe this will work, so.
That's a great point. And as we get to later in the episode, we're going to talk about corporate America. They are looking for a reason to vote for Trump. Yeah. So, all right, well, before we dive into the topics, why don't you remind everybody how we can stay connected?
Yeah, so you can find us at thepoliticslab.com. And as is always the case, we have, you go there, click on this week's episode. I've got, I think, 6 articles this week. So some really interesting stuff we're going to talk about this week. And if you're looking for some more reading, some more background information, you can find those articles at thepoliticslab.com, as well as, you know, all of our, you know, information and email and all of that.
That's great. So, all right, we are going to start today with a reflection on the 30-year anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda. In April of 1994, a genocide played out in which Hutu extremists killed as many as 800,000 Tutsi and moderate Hutu in roughly 90 days. It was the most efficient mass killing since the Holocaust. And despite knowing of the violence and knowing what was going on, the international community and the United States did nothing to stop the genocide. Now, interestingly, 30 years after the genocide, Rwanda is a very different place. As the New York Times noted in an article this week, quote, 30 years after Kigali, Kigali is the envy of Africa. Smooth streets curl past gleaming towers that hold banks, luxury hotels, and tech startups. There's a Volkswagen car plant, an MNRA vaccine facility, a 10,000-seat arena that hosts Africa's biggest basketball league, and concerts by stars like Kendrick Lamar, the American rapper who performed there in December. Tourists fly to visit Rwanda's famed gorillas. Government officials from all over other African countries arrive for lessons in good governance. The electricity is reliable. Traffic cops do not solicit bribes. Violence is rare, right? So this is a summary from the New York Times. That transformation has been ushered in by Paul Kagame, Rwanda's president, who has been in power since 1994, when he led a group of exiled Tutsi soldiers into Rwanda to stop the genocide. Kagame has ruled Rwanda with an iron fist and regularly uses rather harsh methods that would normally attract international condemnation. So in addition to reflecting on all of the above, the Rwandan genocide can also help inform the application of the term genocide to conflicts that we're seeing in Gaza and Ukraine today. And if that's not enough, we can think through the importance of language in fomenting violence and whether Trump, for instance, calling immigrants animals is at all problematic. All right, Phil, let's start with some of the reflections on the 30th anniversary, and then we can grapple with some of these other questions. What are you thinking?
I mean, so this is there's so many elements to this as we look back 30 years later. You know, this was sort of a formative thing for me. Like, this was happening as I was, you know, in graduating high school and going off to college. And so, you know, as I was sort of becoming aware of global politics at a different level. And I think, you know, when we look back and we do memorials and we talk about, you know, tragedies in the past, it is good to memorialize it and remember the human element of it. But I think oftentimes we stop there and don't think about, like, what are the lessons to be learned from this? And so that's when I look back at this, and it's one of those, I think there's, you know, there's so many lessons we can take from this, but just from the beginning, one of the lessons is, like, there are so many things that we think are, you know, that are sort of unfathomable to us, that they can't possibly, you know, this is an example of something that is hard to wrap your head around, that, you know, nearly a million people are killed largely in sort of hand, you know, this is not like... Yeah. This was not that one of the sort of particularly shocking things about Rwanda was that it was not an impersonal form of killing, right? This wasn't guns, it wasn't gas chambers, it was like hand-to-hand violence that led to the death of these of
mostly
800
machetes. I mean, it was brutal, yeah,
brutal, and you know, children, and no one was spared. And I think, you know, it's a good reminder that this is not a African thing. This is a human thing, right? It's important to realize that the conditions, the sort of ethnic conflict, ethnic tensions, this is the sort of thing that has happened throughout humanity, and that we are still prone to. And so, you know, that's the kind of first thing I want to take from this, is that this is not kind of an aberration, right? This is human nature. Maybe at its worst, but it is still human nature, right? And I think there we tend to want to think about how awful this was and then sort of move on with a washing of our hands, like that would never happen here or this wouldn't happen again. And that's where it's also important to realize that stuff like Rwanda was able to happen because we did that sort of same thing with the Holocaust, for instance, right? Where we're like, this was this one time awful thing. And despite all of our promises, never again, when it did happen, we were sort of still unprepared to deal with it. And so I think as we look around the world today, where I think violence is seemingly sort of on the upturn, but certainly, you know, divisions, the sort of backsliding of democracy, it worries me. And I think that it's good in these moments to sort of reflect on instances like this as a reminder of, you know, the conditions that can lead to this sort of mass atrocity again. And the conditions are humanity, right? It's humanity in certain circumstances. And I think that's, I don't know, that's my initial thought. What are your kind of thoughts as you look back big picture at it?
I think that's a really good lesson to think about, right? And you and I have done, we've done some training and some seminars on genocide and the conditions that cause this. And I think that's one of the themes that runs throughout those, right? That this is a human issue. And again, you grapple with the question of how do humans do this to other humans? How do you do it to your neighbors, to your friends and whatnot? And the answer is you dehumanize them, right? And so, this, you know, language matters, identity matters, you know, devaluing, you turn the enemy, the other, into something less than human. And it's pretty textbook when you look back at cases of this, where this mass violence plays out. It doesn't just happen. It happens because there, for years, groups have been targeted with language and dehumanized, and then it makes humans capable of this awful language. So no, I think that's a really important point. The other thing I think that emerges from Rwanda was the inability of the international community to do anything.
Yep.
And some of that is capability, but a lot of it is will, right? There still isn't a desire to intervene and stop these things, you know, humanitarian cases where the world says, oh, this is terrible, never again. And then it happens again. And that part of that is the sovereign state system. But it is a huge deal that the international community is still not capable of addressing those problems.
Yeah, and it's really, it isn't an inability, but it is an inability that derives from an unwillingness, right? It's really an unwillingness of the international community to do something. So, it was, you know, the UN was sort of unable to respond to what was happening, but it was unable to respond to what was happening in Rwanda because of an unwillingness of the international community to act. And so this is too soon to shift gears, but we've kind of touched on several things that have, I don't want to like take the emphasis away from Rwanda, but I think there are like these really valuable lessons in Rwanda that are very pertinent today. And so you've already touched on two of them that I think are worth kind of digging into a little bit. One of which is the use of language, this dehumanizing language. The other of which is the international community's response. And so I look at, you know, in, you know, American politics, international politics, and I think about language, but also, you know, the international response to Israel and the war in Gaza. In particular, I think the American response to Rwanda and the American response to Israel, there's really interesting in parallel. So can we sort of dig into some of those? Do you have which of those two would you want to like touch on first?
Well, should we start with language a little
bit? Yeah, let's do it.
I think that is one that I think, as you said, is really relevant today and a lesson that we forgot. And we spend a lot of time talking about Donald Trump and the language that he uses, but it's not limited to Donald Trump. We could go around the world, you know, throughout Europe, and we think about a lot of these issues about borders and refugee movements and people crossing borders, like how it's the language that's most disturbing and how we've become desensitized to some of Trump's language, right? When you think about, you know, describing immigrants as animals and they're not human. Oh my goodness, right? If you go to some of these Holocaust museums, they talk about the importance of language because that's the first step. You need to dehumanize the other, and that's what he's doing. He's dehumanizing immigrants. And so it's really, really terrible that we sort of forget how important that lesson is. So, your thought. Yeah, because I think you probably have similar ideas in language.
Yeah.
Too,
so,
right?
I mean, if you think about for people who aren't that sort of well versed in the Rwandan genocide, I mean, this was, you know, there were sort of long standing ethnic tensions that went back to colonialism and whatnot in Rwanda between Hutus and Tutsis. One of the things that played out in the lead up to the genocide was there was a lot that fed into it, but a big contributor was there were radio networks that were used to sort of coordinate actions and whatnot. And one of the themes was the use of this dehumanizing language, and the term cockroaches is what was used in the Rwandan genocide, where Tutsis were described as cockroaches. And again, this idea of, you know, what do you do when you have a roach infestation? You exterminate them, you kill them. And so that's the connection doesn't have to be made explicit. It is understood, right? When you're comparing them to a pest, comparing people to a pest, there is this sort of logical conclusion. Right. And that same process was used obviously towards, you know, Jews in the Holocaust. Like, this is a theme in these in mass atrocities throughout time. And that is why I think people who, I don't know, who are just hearing Donald Trump speak and are able to sort of, you know, dismiss his, you know, rhetoric as Trumpian or whatever, I think it's easy to sort of from a distance say, well, you know, why are political scientists getting so upset about his rhetoric? And this is why, because this is one of those patterns that plays out. And so, yeah, when Donald Trump talks about immigrants as animals or rats or, you know, coming from shithole countries, that sort of stuff. Yes. That is all part of that dehumanizing. Again, they're not people. They are, you know, they're an infestation or whatever. And Donald Trump doesn't even have to make that connection because, again, other people are making that connection just from that use of language. And so, even a one-time mention gets, you know, people who study this sort of stuff, anxious. And Donald Trump, it is a repeated pattern over years and years and years. And so, it is yet another way that, you know, this adds fuel to the potential fire of political violence, of violations of human rights, all sorts of stuff that come into play. And again, it is a well-established pattern we see over and over and over in places like Rwanda.
And even, right, so, you know, even if we don't think that there is going to be a genocide playing out on the U.S. border, it will have an impact on policy, right? So, you know, the idea is that whatever this language that's being used is framing the border conflict. And so whatever the United States does, you know, if Trump were to be reelected, or even if Joe Biden is reelected, as you think about how to handle border policies, you've already dehumanized those that are trying to come into the country, which means that that policy is not going to be thinking about those individuals as human beings.
Right.
That frame matters. And it's such an important point you make to say he doesn't have to do it over and over and over again. Once you do it once, mm-hmm. right? And then once the media covers that and says, oh, he thinks these are not humans, that these are animals, right? It allows that interpretation to say anything is fine. Putting people in cages is fine.
Yep.
Separating families, like all of those policies are an outgrowth of the language that you use. And so it's, yeah, I think the parallels to the radio stations in Rwanda are really, really important connection.
And it's not, Donald Trump uses this sort of language. We've talked about this as well in the past. Not just, certainly it's very visible in how he talks about, you know, ethnicity and race and immigration and whatnot. But it's also a similar language that he's using in talking about politics, in which he's characterizing his opponents as in some way, not human,
yeah.
right? Whether that's they're, you know, evil or whatever, it is again this dehumanizing element. So he talks about Democrats in similar ways, and
yes.
all of that feeds into this again. You know, it ultimately leads in, you know, to violence, but it's all these in between steps, which is like, you know, the idea of like compromise and working together. You don't compromise. You don't work together. You don't with vermin, right? And so it is.
Yeah.
It is an effective political strategy, which is why people come back to it. But it is a disastrous political strategy in terms of the human cost and whatnot.
Absolutely. What do you think? So we hear the term genocide. I don't want to say thrown around, but it is used with much greater regularity today. You know,
yep.
we mentioned people talk about a potential genocide in Gaza, in Ukraine, the Uyghur population in China. Like, it feels like that term is used much more frequently. And then the question is it being used appropriately? And, you know, because I think Rwanda is the... It's just like the prototypical case of genocide, where
yep.
it's very clear that the intent of the Hutu majority who was carrying out the genocide was the destruction, in whole or in part. They intended to target the Tutsi population. And so when we think about these conflicts today, we have to come back to that question of intent. Is there an intent to destroy the population? And so I think that's what makes the Ukraine and Gaza and Chinese cases so interesting. But what do you think about the fact that we use this term so much more regularly now?
Well, I think we use it more regularly because of Rwanda, right? So, I mean, I think this is an example of where I think that, you know, prior to the 1990s, and this is, we can tie this into the international community some as well, but prior to the 90s, I think there really was this naive belief that the Holocaust was this, you know, kind of unique situation. And then the 90s come along and we had not just Rwanda, but we had Yugoslavia and Bosnia, basically simultaneously, right? Essentially happening at the same time. And so I think that had, and the international community's failures to deal with those, I think sort of reinvigorated this discussion about genocide. So I think one of the positive developments of this is that the international community and people, everyday people, are aware of the idea of genocide in ways that they hadn't in the past. But yes, I think... you're right in that it's become it is used far more often, and I feel like in some ways in a different way, rather like in it's almost used. This is me just thinking sort of on the spot as I think about the way my students use it or the way I hear it used, not in like an academic community but in the broader community, and it's used less descriptively and more sort of accusatorily, right? In a sense of this is not like, so rather than saying, I think when people are often saying what Israel is doing in Gaza is genocide, it's less about, well, does this meet the legal criteria of genocide? And it's more about saying the intentions of Israel, or Israel's bad, right? That this is bad. And and if Israel is carrying out genocide, then Israel is in fact, you know, that is bad. But it feels like it's become a way of I don't know, sort of coloring the conversation before you actually even get into the facts in some ways. Do you sense that to some extent?
I do. And because there's an important separation between the intent and the action. And I think what we often do as we use the term today, it's more linked to the action. When something really, really horrible is happening, we say that has to be genocide because it's so awful. But if we're, and again, this is maybe just you and I as people who study this for years and kind of narrow in on the legal definition, you know, the legal definition of genocide is you have to intend to do that. So it's a really special category of human rights law where you're looking at there's an intent by one party to target another party for their race, ethnicity, religion, nationality. So the idea in Ukraine is Russia trying to eliminate the Ukrainian nationality. In Gaza are the Israelis trying to eliminate the Palestinians as an identity, or vice versa, right? Is Hamas talking about carrying out and eliminating the Jewish identity? Those are legal definitions, but that are in many ways separate from the actions. And so I think oftentimes we say what's happening in Gaza is so awful. It's such a clear violation of human rights law that it has to be genocide. And it may be, but it could also be crimes against humanity. Yeah. It could also be war crimes. And one of the things that you and I, we've grappled with, and even when we did the genocide and Holocaust seminars, to say that people want to throw genocide as the worst human rights crime. And the reality is, no, like it is a very specific crime. And there are other ones, crimes against humanity, war crimes, aggressive war, all of those are on sort of the same level. But I think you're absolutely right to say that there's sort of an emotional dynamic mm-hmm. to the use today.
Yeah. So I feel like realizing as we talk, we could spend the entire podcast, whole episode talking yes. about this, yeah. I think. But I do want to talk about the international response, but maybe even more so the American response to Rwanda and what that maybe says, or because there's weird parallels to what's going on in Israel in a sort of different kind of way. In the Rwanda case, like looking back on it, like what's become very clear is that the international community knew what was happening. The U.S. certainly knew what was happening. There's even been, you know, even more recent documents that confirm just how much the United States knew what was happening. But the U.S. didn't want to get involved. This was on the heels of Somalia and other kind of failed involvement in Africa. And the U.S. didn't want to get involved. And so it's not just that we chose not to act when genocide was happening. We actually sort of proactively interfered to keep the international community from acting. So there were things that could have been done that were relatively simple, but we were afraid that essentially any international involvement, any international recognition of this as genocide would drag America in. And so we worked against international response. When I look at Israel, there's a similarity even in its like stark differences, in which it feels like the United States, we are, you know, increasingly pressuring Israel, but it does feel like the United States, as opposed to in Rwanda, where it felt like much of the international community was on board with the United States. In this particular instance, it feels like the U.S. is sort of alone in this, but it feels in a similar way like the U.S. is the one trying to prevent international action for its own sort of reasons. And it feels like there's all sorts of important lessons to be learned there. But I mean, this is, again, like seeing the human cost of kind of America's unwillingness to act or whatever. I don't know. It feels like there's a lot that we can take from that. That's even not saying, you know, whether what Israel is doing, I'm not trying to say that what Israel is doing is genocide, but this the lesson involved, in which like we get so caught up in kind of the abstract principles that I think we miss the human cost so often. And that I feel like is something that we should be reminded of as we look at what's going on in Israel and Gaza from a U.S. foreign policy standpoint.
That's a really interesting point. And listeners should direct all of their complaints at phil@thepoliticslab.com, not Bill. So no, I think you're raising a really interesting point. And as you were talking, I was thinking about the difference, right? So one could make an argument that the United States was on the wrong side in both instances, yeah. right? So Bill Clinton was president. Now the difference though is in the 94 genocide, the rest of the international community yes. was with the United States, yep. right? And looking at Rwanda saying, this is a humanitarian issue. why should we threaten our soldiers, our sovereignty, all of that for getting involved? So it was, there was no real interest in there. So the United States led, along with France and others, saying, like, let's not get involved. In this instance, the United States could, one could argue, is also on the wrong side of history, but doing so for strategic interest, right?
Because they do have interests. Yes.
Right. Long-standing alliance with Israel. And so there's value in maintaining that, even though the pressure from the rest of the world is increasingly on Joe Biden and domestically, right? I mean, he is suddenly, his presidential bid is being undermined by this position. So it's just a really interesting thing. Two instances where the U.S., again, could be on the wrong side of history, but one for indifference and the other for strategic interest. I think it's a really, really, you're finding a really important parallel.
Yeah, I mean, in both cases, it is the abstract getting, like, I can see a situation in which, well, a little bit like you and I, right? Like, we're able to sit here and talk about the concepts, the big picture stuff without actually, you know, having to wrestle with the actual human toll that's being carried. And I feel like oftentimes policymakers are doing that same thing. And so American policymakers are busy playing some big game of chess without like realizing the actual impact of their actions. The lesson is, you know, to be constantly reminded of the human impact of policies. Like that's what we have to, I think, come back around to.
Well, and it's compelling that this 30-year anniversary is coming at a time when it's so relevant to a lot of these other issues. So we should transition. You're right. We could keep going, but let's talk about corporate America, Phil. We don't spend enough time talking about corporate America.
Well, we have talked a lot over the years about the danger that populism generally and Donald Trump more specifically pose to democracy in America. But we thought we'd take some time today to talk about the threat that populism and Trump pose to the economy as well. Maybe that feels minor compared to democracy, but it's not minor. Trump's first term was, in fact, pretty chaotic, but it did bring significant tax cuts for corporations and it brought extensive deregulation. And many in the corporate world are counting on a similar pattern in a potential second term. Jonathan Mahler had an article in the New York Times, an excellent piece this week, that talked about how, you know, essentially there's all sorts of evidence that corporate America is sort of coming to peace with the idea of a second Trump term. But as Mahler points out, there are reasons to be skeptical. So economies thrive on predictability. And populism has shown itself over and over and over again to be unpredictable. Trump, like many populists, looks to take a different tack in his second term than in his first. He's already proposed drastic trade policies against not only China, but the world as a whole, up to 10% tariffs on all imported goods. That would be partnered with bans on foreign investment, weakening of the Federal Reserve, a massive deportation scheme that, in addition to the human costs, would wreak havoc on the labor market. And populists have also, I mean, they're called populists because they've historically used the power of the state to target their enemies and to implement policies that are seen as, quote, friendly to the people, but often economically unviable and destabilizing. So we don't have to look far to see what these policies look like. Viktor Orban in Hungary is one example. One that listeners might be more comfortable or aware of is Britain after Brexit, which you can see the sort of economic impact there. But the list goes on and on and on. Bill, this is an area where I see a theme that we've come back around to multiple times, which is specifically, we talked about this on the first topic, the tendency to think that the worst case scenario wouldn't play out here, while history and comparative politics show us again and again just how bad things can get. So let's dig in. Should corporate America be more concerned about a second Trump term? Should the average American be concerned about what a Trump term looks like economically? And why are we so reluctant to believe that it's going to happen here? Where do you want to start with this?
Let's start with this. You know, where should the concern be? And obviously, our listeners know that you and I are concerned, but we're concerned for democratic reasons, right? So we're thinking about this in the threat that authoritarianism, the threat that populism poses. And so that's how we framed our conversations over the last couple of years. Corporate America has a different interest, right? Corporate America is thinking about profits and losses and the free market, their ability to continue to go out there and do the things that they've been able to do since post-World War II, right? The neoliberal economic model. And does Trump pose a threat to that? And I would suggest he sent very, very mixed messages. All of the things that you highlighted should cause alarm bells to be going off in corporate America to say, this guy is going to be pursuing protectionism. He's going to engage in trade wars. He's going to undermine multilateral trade deals. We potentially could shift in a recession where, you know, global trade is under. They should be incredibly worried. Yet at the same time, so this last week he had a fundraiser with very wealthy people, including a handful of billionaires. And he apparently behind the scenes told them, don't worry, I'm not going to raise your taxes, right? So he's sending these very, very mixed messages. And it appears that those messages to the very rich corporate Americans are winning, right? So the article you mentioned had this guy, Jamie Dimon, who's the CEO for
J.P. Morgan,
J.P. Morgan, right? So he's a big deal. And in that article, they quote him in saying, he's talking about Trump. And he says, be honest, sitting against, Trump was kind of right about NATO. He was kind of right on immigration. He grew the economy. Tax reform worked. He was right about China. I'm reading this thinking like, this is a very smart, very powerful individual who is clearly convincing himself that it is in his economic and sort of financial interest to back Trump. And I found myself saying, wow, I am stunned because, Phil, you'll be surprised to know I am not a bigwig on the financial markets, but I think I would be very concerned if I were corporate America, because if Trump pursues any of the sort of populist agenda he has laid out, it would be devastating, much, much more devastating than Joe Biden's minor regulation, right? Joe Biden's a free marketeer who regulates at the margins. What Trump is talking about is a throwback to a much more economic isolation. So I think they should be worried. How about yourself? How are you reading all of this?
Yeah, no, I think you're 100% right. I think that Donald Trump is proposing, I mean, his policy, the stuff he's talking about is essentially this desire to go back to a pre-globalized world, right? In which we're doing our own thing. We're self-sufficient. We're not sort of tied to, but if you're Jamie Dimon or if you're, you know, any of these other, like the financial boom that America has seen is based on globalization. It's based on foreign aid. It's based on, I mean, foreign investment. It's based on trade. It's based on integrated markets. And so if Donald Trump's going to pull America back from that, then it is going to unravel all of these successes. And so I think, you know, we've talked about how the average voter sort of has a hard time connecting. It's easy to see lost jobs to trade and not to see the sort of abstract positive benefits of trade that it creates all these other jobs and it lowers prices and all of that. The corporate CEOs in finance should be well aware of the benefits of trade in a way that, but this is an example again of, again, not believing that the worst will happen here. And it's also this weird, peculiar thing about Donald Trump where his chaotic nature, his sort of all over the place approach, this sort of shotgun approach to policy where, you know, it's going to be I'm totally opposed to abortion, but I'm also supportive of abortion rights. And also, right, you know, in this case, I'm going to cut taxes and I'm the candidate of the rich man. And also I'm going to go out and have these rallies where I say I'm the candidate of the common man. And there's this human tendency to, when he puts all that stuff out there, this is where, you know, cognitive bias and information screens and motivated thinking comes into play. It's where Jamie Dimon can tell himself what Donald Trump really means is what he tells me behind closed doors.
That's right.
And all
that's
the
great
voters can, all the, you know, the people at a Trump rally can say what Trump really means is what he's telling us. And he's, you know, those big wig corporate people are the suckers who are buying into it. So everybody can sort of convince themselves that the Donald Trump that they want is the real Donald Trump, when in fact, the real Donald Trump is the one who's like out there, like the one that he is who he's saying he is, which is like, he's going to change on a whim, depending on who he's talking to. He has no, real policy behind it. And that really the real Donald Trump is whatever benefits him, right? Like that's what's going to happen. And so, I mean, the the ability that we have to convince ourselves of, you know, that in fact what he's saying is what I want him to say is remarkable. But it's a very human thing too.
It is, and it forces us to grapple with who is the real Donald Trump. Is he really the populist authoritarian that his language suggests, or is he just somebody who's really self-interested, transactional, and if he gets back in office, he's going to look to benefit himself financially as he did the first time? It's hard to know, although I will say this, the rhetoric coming out of him and his team suggests that he's much more deeply yes. committed to the populist agenda than he was the first time. He didn't think he was going to get elected. There wasn't really any sort of deep philosophical approach to this. So if we take him at his word and what those around him who genuinely believe in a sort of economic populism, I think corporate America should be concerned. And what's interesting about this article and other sort of commentaries is that those who look at the history of economic populism say the result is very clear, right? I mean, you look at something like Brexit, where it has been devastating yeah. for the United Kingdom's economy, or you look at Orban, or you look at, I think Vladimir Putin's another yeah. one, where you have autocratic control of your market. They use that term in the article, autocratic capture, which I love, is the idea that the authoritarian uses their power to control the market. And if you're close to the authoritarian, you have benefits and you can do very, very well. Putin's a very rich man and those are around him, but it's not the same thing as a truly free market. Yep. So, I mean, that if you're on Trump's good side, it could be very, very beneficial. But if you're not, you know, they argue that the business community should be very worried about their potential losses. Think about Ron DeSantis he's a great example in Florida, where he has targeted Disney. That's not a traditional conservative view of supporting corporate America and the free market. You're targeting a particular business. So, you know, if you get on Trump's wrong side for whatever reason, and he is truly an economic populist, that could be bad for business.
Yeah, I think you can't. There's this weird, like when Donald Trump is, like you said, is when he's out talking about, you know, ending trade and punishing China. And like, I don't know how you don't believe it. Right. It's yeah. again, one of those notions that, if I were, you know, Jamie Dimon or others, I those would be red flags. Like you said, the other part is the difference in the first Trump term, when Trump surrounded himself with kind of corporate like America types, and he's not surrounding himself with those types, which should give you an indication of who he sees as, you know, loyal or supporting him. And yeah, I mean, it stands to be massively devastating for the American economy to go down this road. It's amazing to see, I don't know, to see how people are convinced to buy into it.
Well, that bias is really, really, really fascinating to think about. How you're right. You look at Trump, if you are corporate America, and you say, like, it'll be fine. He's whispering in my ear, I shouldn't worry about this. But Orban and Putin, all these other guys whispered in their ears, like, it's going to be great. Don't worry.
Yes. Yes. And again, none of that also takes into the account, like you said, I think the true Donald Trump is a totally self-interested Donald Trump. So it's one of those where if you can convince Donald Trump that, I don't know, putting in place policies that benefit JP Morgan are in his best interest, then you can get it. But the other part of it is, I think that so much of Donald Trump, this all of his focus on retribution, and I think so much of Donald Trump is knee jerk. It is like the Democrats say this, and so I'm going to do the opposite. And so I think what you'll see happen is he'll get in office, he'll propose limits on, you know, trade internationally. Economists, you know, Democrats will come out and say this is a bad idea, and it'll lead him to sort of double down on it more. It's not going to be a pretty picture, I don't think. I mean, the other part of this, I think about this, is there's this weird aspect of looking at, and I'm not a political economist. There are people who specialize in this, but there is this trajectory where sort of more authoritarian, more state control can be effective for economic growth. But it's effective in places like China. It's effective in places like Rwanda. It's effective in places that are sort of beginning the developmental trajectory. And having a strong state to kind of direct that kind of export-led growth is effective. It does not work for a place that, like the United States, which has the world's largest economy and depends on trade to sort of stay at that point. And so, you know, I think that's what people want. They want, a lot of people want this strong government to take America forward economically. And it just doesn't work that way. It would work that way again if we were, a developing Central American state or whatever, but not when you're the United States.
I love that example. It also matters what is the goal of those who are managing the economy, right? So China, Rwanda, the East Asian, miracle countries, they all were looking to generate economic growth. Mm-hmm. And that was driving the state-led policy. I think, as you noted, Donald Trump would be looking to benefit himself and his friends. That's a very different way of structuring state management of the economy, right? Again, all of these things, as political scientists, I look at and say, like, boy, the business world should be troubled. But they're like, it's going to be okay, Phil. It's going to be fine.
It's all going to be fine.
So we can stop talking about it because it's going to be all right.
It's like a self-soothing thing, right? It'll be all right.
It'll be fine. All right, should we transition to some international law?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so for our final topic, we're going to look at three recent events that raise some really interesting questions regarding international law. First up is Ecuador, where the Ecuadorian police burst into the Mexican embassy and arrested Jorge Glass, Ecuador's former vice president. Our next stop will take us to Germany, where on Tuesday, the German government was defending itself at the International Court of Justice against accusations that its arms shipments to Israel or furthering genocide in Gaza. Last stop, Switzerland, where also on Tuesday, the European Court of Human Rights found that the Swiss government had violated its citizens' human rights by not doing enough to stop climate change. All right, Phil, let's take these in order and start in Ecuador. A little bit more background here, where diplomatic relations between Mexico and Ecuador imploded this week after the Ecuadorian police burst into this Mexican embassy, knocked over diplomats, and arrested Ecuador's former vice president. Former vice president has been residing there since December, so he's been hanging out and has been seeking asylum after being indicted on corruption charges. Mexico is, they're just pissed and plans to challenge the raid at the International Court of Justice, noting that 18 countries in Latin America, 20 in Europe, and the Organization of American States have all backed Mexico. Our listeners may not know this, but Phil has spent a lot of time hiding in foreign embassies. So, Phil, why is breaking down the door of a foreign embassy such a big deal?
Because I just want to be left alone. Like, why can't they just leave me alone? No, this is so from an international. I try to make this. I don't know, when I teach international law and we talk about diplomacy or whatever, like that. International law is kind of weird in its own way. Yeah. Like it doesn't come into being in sort of there's no international legislature. It's sort of what countries have agreed upon. You can sort of look at how countries behave and how they talk, and you can sort of figure out what the international community has agreed upon. And diplomacy and things like diplomatic immunity and the treatment of embassies is like one of the foundational ideas. I mean, this is one of the ideas of international law that has been in place forever, right? This is going back to the notion of not killing the messenger. It's the idea that, diplomacy is good. And so we're going to sort of respect each other's diplomats and whatnot. And to show the extent, I mean, the fact that like you can think of a handful of times when embassies were violated, and they are such a big deal. Whether it's the Iran hostage situation when people stormed the American embassy in Iran, it was such a huge deal because that never happens. The Benghazi stuff, right? The attack on an American diplomat, that wasn't an embassy, but there's a reason why it's such a huge deal. The one that I come back around to was when America invaded Panama to arrest Noriega. We invaded a foreign country, arrested their president, both of which are not allowed under international law. But when he hid in the Vatican embassy, we were like, we're not going there. We'll stop there. So we will invade a country and arrest their president, but we will not violate the embassy of a foreign country. So this is a really, really, really big deal. And yeah, Mexico is right to be pissed. Like this is, this is the thing where if Ecuador has a problem with it, there are cases that you can go to the International Court of Justice. There have been other cases that deal with whether or not diplomatic asylum is allowed. Just storming the front door is not one of the ones that's allowed. I mean, what's your take on all of this?
I love that you brought up the Panama example because it's such a great one, right? And so when Noriega's hiding out, like, we don't want to go into the Vatican's embassy, but we had no problem blasting music like 24 hours a day to like make him come out, which made me think, if you were some diplomat just, you know, from the Vatican sitting there and they're blasting, I don't know, AC/DC, whatever you blast at that point, like, had to be just like, come on, man.
You can find the playlist that American like psychological operatives came up with, and it's fantastic to go. But there's even like on Spotify, you can find the Manuel Noriega playlist, and it's stuff that is like, I don't know, the idea of what was like destabilizing in, you know, 40 years ago is pretty remarkable and pretty humorous.
It is, but as you correctly highlight, this is a big deal, and it goes all the way back to this idea of diplomatic immunity. There's value when states can talk to each other and know that they can have a presence in another state. Oftentimes, we think that these embassies are actually sovereign territory, and they're not. Yeah. But there's a norm that has developed to say that we're going to pretend that they are, right? That even though this is the actual territory of the sovereign state, we're going to grant them, you know, that space to say that is their own space. The Vienna Convention on Consular Relations, if we want to get really nerdy, establishes this, where states say, yes, we are going to protect this because it is in everybody's interest to have dialogue, to have exchange, right? You mentioned don't kill the messenger. That used to be the old day. Like in the olden days, when somebody from another country came in, you just kill them, yeah, right? And, you know, that's not good for conversation, right? So there's, you create some protection here. And Mexico is falling in these examples of just blatantly violating it. I'm sorry, Ecuador is violating it. And Mexico yesterday released the video. And it's really something where you see the diplomat who's like trying to put a bookcase behind the door to stop them. Then he gets pushed over. And then they haul the vice president out. It's just not good optics for Ecuador.
Well, and there's something particularly rich or hypocritical about this, because Ecuador is the embassy that let Julian Assange hang out for years, but even though there were arrest warrants out for him. So, you know, there's this blatant hypocrisy in which they're willing to say, we will shield someone from prosecution for years and years and years. But the instant you try to shield someone from us, we're busting down the doors and coming in. It is remarkable.
All right, well, let's jump to our next case, which takes us to Germany, where, as I noted, Germany finds itself facing accusations that it is furthering a genocide, providing arms shipments to Israel. This time it's Nicaragua. They argued before the International Court of Justice that Germany was facilitating the commission of genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza by providing Israel with military and financial aid, and specifically asked for emergency measures from the court ordering the German government to halt its support. Germany said that the allegations brought by Nicaragua had, quote, no basis in fact or law. Phil, this is a powerful accusation, and given the history of the parties involved, a very politically charged one. Yeah. It also forces us to return to the fundamental definition of genocide and whether its application to the conflict in Gaza is appropriate. So what do you think about this recent case?
This is really interesting. I mean, so this is a hard case to prove, right? I mean, in that, so this is one of the things we should just sort of point out, that the argument that's being made, if you go and read the Genocide Convention lays out specifically, you know, what genocide is, right? That you're intending to destroy in whole or part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group. And that can include things like killing, causing bodily harm, imposing measures intended to prevent births, forcibly transferring children, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction. So that's what that one in particular, I think, is going to be. You know, you've got the killing, but you've also got conditions of life. And so this really begins with this sort of South Africa case. Can you prove that what is happening in Gaza is genocide? And I think that's a challenging case to make. But if they can make that case, and that's a whole conversation to be had. The other thing that, you know, the Genocide Convention says that genocide is punishable, but so is conspiracy to commit genocide and complicity in genocide. So this is the argument that if South Africa can, if the ICJ does find that Israel is committing genocide, then essentially what Nicaragua is saying is, by providing the weapons to do it, Germany becomes complicit in genocide, right? And so that's, If it is genocide, that's a big if, but if it is genocide, then Nicaragua is kind of in the right here. And the fact that it's targeting Germany, I think, is is a particularly symbolic, statement as well. And so, there's lots of ifs, there's lots of dots that have to be connected to get there. But the core idea behind it is really sort of fascinating. Yeah.
It is. As a legal matter, I find this really interesting, right? And again, connecting the dots as you did to say that if the argument that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza is found to be credible, then those who are aiding Israel, Germany, but also the United States, right? I think this circles back to where we started, would also be complicit in that process. So now we should say, and I firmly believe this, that there are smart people on both sides of that genocide debate in Gaza, really, really smart people saying that it has met the definition of genocide, and equally smart and credible people who are saying, like, this is not genocide, right? That is something, maybe war crimes, crimes against humanity, but it does not rise to the level of genocide because you can't demonstrate intent. So, like, that's difficult. And for me, I sort of come at it that way. I say, I get that what Nicaragua and South Africa are doing, but I think the easier case would be saying, like, hey, you are complicit in crimes against humanity, in war crimes. That would be the easier legal case to make, to say that, hey, Israel is not doing enough to distinguish between combatants and non-combatants, and in doing so is violating these fundamental rules of international law. That, I think, is a much easier case to make.
Yep.
But where the legal conversations are landing really is around this issue of genocide. Yep. And it makes for a fascinating legal discussion, but it does make it more difficult to make that case.
Right. Yes, this is where going to that genocide trump card is the sort of natural reaction, but it may not be the smartest legal reaction. The other interesting part of this, because I know we need to move on to our third case, that I find really interesting is and this is sort of a chance to have a very short lesson in international law, which is, why Germany? And I think there's symbolic aspects to Germany, but Germany is the second largest supplier of weapons to Israel behind the United States. But the way the ICJ is set up, the International Court of Justice, it is a, UN-affiliated body. Countries have the opportunity to choose how they come to the court. And one of the things that countries can do is they can sign on to essentially this protocol that says any time a case is brought to the ICJ, we'll allow the ICJ to have jurisdiction. And Germany has signed on to that. So they don't, when Nicaragua brings this case, Germany has in advance already said anybody who brings a case will consider. Yeah. The U.S. had in the past signed this, but a couple of cases went our way and went against us and we withdrew our signature. So even though the U.S. is the largest supplier of weapons to Israel, if Nicaragua had brought this case against the U.S., the U.S. just would have said, no, we're not doing that. We don't recognize the court's jurisdiction in this case. So this is why the U.S. is bypassed and they've gone after Germany. But it's where these sort of small nuances, there's the politics of law that comes into play as well here. And it's kind of interesting to see how that plays out. And will this have an impact on Germany and their willingness to sort of recognize the court moving forward as well?
It's such a great point. I hadn't thought about that, but you're right. The United States would be the primary target, but following, going all the way back to the Reagan administration, where the United States was mining the Nicaraguan harbors and we lost that case, the United States said, we're taking our toys and going home, right? So you can't come after the United States in that way unless the U.S. Agrees to that. Oh, that's great stuff. All right, let's jump to our last case, which brings us to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, France, where the court found that the Swiss government had violated its citizens' human rights by not doing enough to stop climate change. The case was brought by a group called Senior Women for Climate Protection.
You're a member of that, right, Bill?
I am. Yes, okay. Yes. There's a real name, but that was too complicated for me to pronounce. So we're going with Senior Women for Climate Protection. And they argue that Switzerland had failed to meet its target in reducing carbon emissions. And they argue that that has put their health at risk and the government has not done enough to mitigate against global warming. And in doing so, has violated their rights. It's the latest decision in a broader wave of climate-related lawsuits that aim to push governments to act against global warming. But it is notable that this is the first instance of a court actually determining that governments were legally obligated to meet their climate targets under human rights law. Another great case. Phil, what do you think about this one?
This is really fascinating. I mean, this is the other part when, to go back to the beginning, our first conversation, international law evolves, right? And it evolves as all law does. But rather than, legislating, it evolves in sort of how countries behave. And as countries start to act, increasingly in certain ways, that sort of becomes new versions of international. That's an oversimplified version of it, but that's kind of how it plays out. But this is a really interesting one as well, where Over the past 75 years, human rights law has evolved dramatically from, you know, at the end of World War II, the international community basically said, yeah, there's human rights, but they're, you know, very vague and we can't really agree on it. And what has happened over the subsequent 75 years is those definitions of human rights have become increasingly concrete, increasingly recognized by international legal venues, by courts and other places. And this is sort of a monumental decision because it connects human rights documents, which are these ideas that everyone is entitled to certain things, to the environment. So there have been environmental treaties that have been passed, lots of them, and there have been a lot of human rights treaties, but this connecting of the two, this idea that essentially you have a right to life and that failure to act on the environment is actually, you know, in this particular case, these Swiss women were arguing that, you know, that essentially extreme heat is, you know, harmful to elderly people in particular. And so there is this kind of discrimination, like a failure to act is sort of discriminatory against older people, and the court, you know, supported this notion. And the European Court of Human Rights is not a small thing. Like this is one of the major courts in the international system that deal with these sorts of issues. And the implications are, I think, real. I think it will continue to, you'll likely see more cases like this, but you start to, again, this connection starts to grow. And to the extent that the environment becomes a human right, it's going to have an impact on things. It's really significant, really fascinating. What's your take on this?
I tend to agree. I think it's a really clever way for citizens to push for their rights, right? Mm-hmm. To use a legal mechanism to say, like, hey, you pledged to do this, and, you know, you signed and ratified this, like, and you said you were doing it, and there are negative impacts because you haven't upheld your bargain, right? So I think it's really smart, and I'm glad to see more of this. I think the question then will be, like, the credibility of these courts. Mm-hmm. Like, because the United States, if there was some court to say, the United States, you haven't done what you need to do and you are liable, you know, the United States wouldn't respect that. But it's interesting to see that I think European courts are much more likely to do so. Yep. And it might be that nudge that governments need to be a bit more proactive, right? Because mm-hmm. it's not just the government making these decisions in a vacuum. It's the idea that the public is pushing for this and there are legal consequences to this, right? So it creates a little bit of momentum to make more meaningful change in terms of trying to meet those pledges for the Paris Climate Accord. So I don't think it solves all your problems, but I do, again, I find it a clever way of nudging states in a more positive direction. So I applaud it, and I think it's a correct way for citizens yep. to say, like, hey, climate matters and it's impacting my rights. You said you'd do something and
you should have to do it. Yeah. And I think you're right. Yeah. And I think that, you know, there's the cynicism about international law and that sort of stuff that comes from America, because America is in this weird position of, like, being sort of a founding member of so many of these human rights documents and international. But also, as a world power, sort of one of the more prominent examples of countries who will sort of ignore some of these provisions. And so it's easy to look at but I think it was never going to begin with the United States, right? It's like you said, if it's Switzerland, if that then becomes sort of a European expectation and all the European countries get on board, other countries start doing that, that all creates a snowball effect, which make it increasingly uncomfortable for the United States to be on the outside looking in terms of countries who are not meeting, you know, if the rest of the world basically says, if you're not acting on the environment, you're violating human rights. The U.S. has to eventually start explaining why they don't right. see it that way. So
why they're the outlier, right? Yeah. And again, it creates legal momentum, right? And I guess maybe moral momentum to say that these are things that we need to do. Yeah. My favorite memory, so a few years, actually more than a few years, I took a group of students and we visited the European Court of Human Rights, and we were there actually for a case on torture, and they were going after Poland. But it's a fantastic institution. It's in Strasbourg, France. We were there during the Christmas markets, and after we'd spend day at the trial, I'd always go down to the Christmas markets, and there was an outdoor market that had spätzle, the little noodles, and they put sausage over it, and then a little sauce. That was my post-trial meal. I would wander down every day, and it was like the most amazing thing, because Strasbourg is this wonderful mix of French and German cuisine, because it's been invaded by French and Germany, you know, yeah. over and over and over. And it was, oh my goodness. Whenever I hear the European Court of Human Rights, I think about that spätzle and sausage and smile.
In Bill Muck's book, what you're saying is, two contributions to humanity that Strasbourg has brought, European Court of Human Rights, spätzle with sausage, equally important.
Oh, so good. Yes. Yeah, we could spend some time debating that, but I'll just put them both on a plateau. Both good things. So, all right. On that note, we should probably wrap up. Remind everybody, Phil, how they can stay connected, because like you said, there's some really interesting articles we put up today.
So yeah, thepoliticslab.com. You go there, click on this week's episode. And we've got an article on each of those three international legal cases, which I think are all fascinating in their own rights. We've got two articles on the Rwandan genocide, and then that New York Times piece that talks about corporate America and the threats of populism. All six of those are at thepoliticslab.com.
That is fantastic. All right, Phil, I'll see you next week.
Bye, Bill.
Bye, Phil.